Hello, and welcome to Catholicism in the Car. My name is Parker Zerba. Today, I want to continue our discussion from the last episode. Last episode, we were talking about creationism versus the sort of theistic evolutionary positions. We discussed at the end of that episode what it means to be agnostic on certain issues, particularly as a Christian. And I think this is a very important topic that I don't think I've ever heard anyone kind of flesh this out in any real way. Like, when is it okay for us to be agnostic on an issue? And this doesn't just go for Christians. This means for anybody, I think. What sorts of questions in life ought we to make determinations of? Ought we to make choices on, decisions on? And then what kinds of questions don't necessarily need to have direct answers for us? We can stay agnostic on them. We can say, I don't know, to them, and feel fine with that, right? I don't think that we need an answer to everything in this life, and I don't think we can have an answer to everything in this life. Now, the way that this came up in our last episode, for those of you who are just coming in, and if you're just coming in and you want to feel free to go back and listen to that episode, I would encourage you to, because I think it'll give a lot of basis for what we're going to talk about this time. But we were discussing the difference within Christianity today between a sort of creationism, particularly like a seven-day creationism, but there are various types of more literal creationisms where you would take the first few chapters of Genesis much more literally than other Christians would do. And then the other side of that debate would be more of an evolutionary, friendly view, a view that's much more friendly to the evolutionary theory. And now, a side note, what's interesting is the evolutionary theory has evolved quite a lot over the last 150 years. The evolutionary theory today is not the evolutionary theory of Darwin. It's quite a bit different. And you know, I'm not a scientist, so I'm not gonna, or an evolutionary biologist. So I'm not gonna really flesh this out here. That's not really my case. I have like a general idea of it, but you know, I don't know about this stuff very well in depth. I'm much more inclined to philosophy and theology. So we were discussing these two issues, and I kind of gave my own opinion at the end there, saying how I take an agnostic view on this issue, on whether we, you know, the answer is a theistic evolution, or if it's like strict creationism, as, you know, might be common among Christians, taking a seven-day literal creation or something close to that, right? And we were saying how, like, I think that there are certain issues that we should feel obliged to make decisions on because of how the answer to said question would kind of ripple through our lives and how we live our lives. So I gave the example of the question of God. I think the question of God is something that it's very difficult to stay agnostic on, practically speaking, because of how pervasive the effects of what one's answer is to that question are on one's life. So if I say, you know, no, I don't believe in God, I really do. I have to construct a lot of different ways of seeing morality. I have to construct a lot of different ways of seeing, you know, the origins of reality in general. I have to construct a lot of reasonings for psychology and human interaction and my relations with other human beings. And not that theists don't have to do this, but particularly if you take more of a classical theist kind of a view, I think it's much easier for people coming from a classical theist type of a view to kind of see how love of neighbor, a lot of facets of morality, how our understanding of ourselves as being inherently good, how those things flow from the idea of an all good, infinite, omnipotent, omniscient first principle or creator, right? I think it's much easier to see how those things flow from that kind of an idea of God than would flow from an atheistic worldview. And I think that I haven't heard many people give this sort of an argument. And, you know, that could be because it's a bad argument. And I'm just not seeing all the holes in it, which is very possible. But a lot of people don't argue, from what I've seen, that they don't argue from the effects of a worldview, right? Some people do, but it's not as common to argue in this way. Like, I would say if one is agnostic on the issue of God, that then basically leaves one agnostic on every other issue of reality, because God, the even just the concept of God, as human beings hold it, is, by definition, at least in classical theism, is the first principle of all of reality. And so if you don't have an idea of whether the first principle exists, or what that first principle is, then it's going to be very difficult, I think, to make conclusions about the rest of reality that sort of flows from or derives itself from that first principle. And, you know, whether you believe the first principle is omniscient, omnipotent, you know, all-powerful, and whatnot, whether you believe in the first principle as being that of classical theism, or whether you believe the first principle as just being the beginning of the Big Bang, which, you know, I mean, I guess you could probably parcel that out and say, and still be an atheist, you know, I think you definitely could, and say, you know, somehow the Big Bang started, and yet, you know, there is no God, per se. But I guess, do you see what I'm saying? Like, the question, or the answer to that question of ultimate origins, of first principles, it resounds through the rest of our lives. So I think questions like that, where they have profound effects on how we view the rest of reality, and not just intellectually how we view it, but how we act in reality, those sort of questions require answers of us, I would argue. Whereas there are other types of questions that don't necessarily require answers. And again, last episode, I gave the example of the strict creationist versus theistic evolutionist debate within Christianity. I don't think a Christian necessarily needs to take a side on that issue, because ultimately, we still believe, both sides still believe that everything, that God is the first principle, and we both believe that, you know, at least generally speaking, we both believe in a classical theistic definition of God, and so the rest of everything that follows from that is going to be virtually the same. It's just the means are a little bit different, but the ends are the same. And what I mean by that is the means of creation are going to be a little bit different, but the ends of creation are going to be the same in both of those views. So I think that this is a good principle for how we should evaluate whether we can be agnostic on an issue or not, is to say, does this issue resound or have a chain of effects throughout my thinking and my acting, or does it not? If it doesn't substantially change my thinking or my acting, I think then one can safely be agnostic on such an issue. Now, there are certainly for many Christians certain things that have been revealed by divine revelation that they would need to adhere to and make a good submission of intellect and will to, right? But from a purely philosophical point of view, a purely human point of view, I think that this is a good standard to take. If it doesn't have resounding effects upon my my outlook upon reality, whether that be in my acting or in my thinking, then I can stay agnostic on said issue. Now, and I think there's another way of viewing this that's also helpful. And it kind of is, instead of starting from philosophy and moving towards, you know, maybe moving towards conclusions that have been revealed, or, you know, I guess what I'm saying is moving from an inductive argument, so moving from saying, well, I see all these evidences and they're bringing me towards a certain conclusion, you can also apply this to a certain extent to a deductive argumentation, which is saying that you start with a certain assumption or premise and then you move towards certain conclusions, right? It's kind of a easy way to think about these deductive versus inductive arguments. And honestly, I still get them confused sometimes. I like will confuse the names of each one. So I'm hoping I'm getting this one right, and I think I am. So I think looking at this question of agnosticism from a deductive standpoint, where we would start with revelation and move towards certain conclusions, I think that it can be helpful, particularly for Christians to do this at times. And we can kind of use that as an apologetical sort of a tool. And I'm thinking particularly for Catholics on this issue, if we were to think of the question of Mary's assumption, let's say her bodily assumption into heaven at the end of her earthly life, whether she was, you know, whether it was more of a dormition and she fell asleep and then was assumed, or whether she was just, you know, awake and assumed, you know, that's a debate we can still have, but the fact is that by divine revelation, for Catholics at least, and most Orthodox, we would believe that Mary was assumed into heaven. And that belief of revelation is derivative from a lot of understandings that Catholics and Orthodox have about human nature and of reality, but it also points us towards a lot of things regarding human nature and reality. And I'll take this as a good example because I think it is a good example of how Catholics and Orthodox in particular view human nature. And it would be this, that human nature is a body-soul composite, and that death, it was not meant to be. And the assumption of Mary, it flows really necessarily from our doctrine of the Immaculate Conception. And I think I had a whole episode on this, maybe 40 or so episodes before this one. I'm guessing it was like in the 80s. You can look at it. You can go back and look at it. I had one on Mary and the Assumption. And just how the Assumption of Mary, it flows logically from our dogma of the Immaculate Conception. Because if Mary was immaculately conceived, meaning she had no original sin, then therefore the effects of original sin, aka death, would not apply to her. And so thus, she would not die, and thus she would need to bodily be assumed into heaven. Now, what's interesting here is that Jesus was also immaculately conceived, right? Jesus had no original sin, but yet Jesus died. Jesus died. And so this is actually where the question that is still being debated, to my knowledge, about Mary's assumption is still a valid question. It's that did she, and I might have phrased this a little wrong at the beginning of this episode, did Mary die before her assumption, or was she just assumed into heaven? Like, maybe she died and then her body was assumed, and then she basically resurrected either on her way up or once she got there, basically. Because Jesus also died. Jesus being, you know, in as much as it's possible to be more immaculately conceived than Mary, Jesus was more immaculately conceived than Mary because of his hypostatic union, his the union of his human nature and his divine nature in one person. And so, you know, basically, since he was God. Since Jesus was God, you know, clearly whatever could happen to Jesus could have also happened to Mary. Now, you know, one argument would be that Jesus freely took upon death for the salvation of our sins. That was the end of his incarnation, as it was necessary for him, for it to happen after the original sin, right? So, whereas for Mary, the redemption had already been achieved by Jesus, and so it was not necessary for her to die because she did not contract the effects of original sin, the main of which would be death, and thus she had no need to die. And thus, you know, that idea of her assumption would be that she didn't die and then her body was assumed. Whereas the other idea would say, well, you know, it's very probable that she did die, maybe in conformity to her son or offering it up for the salvation of souls, offering up that suffering for the salvation of souls, and then her, you know, her soul was assumed in death, and then her body followed, and they were united once she got to her end, her state. And I think this is a point that bears clarification as well. People will often ask, what happened to Jesus's resurrected body, and then also, you know, Mary's assumed body after their, you know, assumed after Jesus's ascension and Mary's assumption, right? Where do they go? Because if heaven is just the state of the soul in the beatific vision as separate from the body, then how in the world could Jesus and Mary's bodies be there? And this question could also apply to Old Testament figures such as Enoch or Elijah, you know. So, and I think there might be a few others that I'm blanking on right now, but Old Testament figures where it's fairly clear that, you know, it seems that they were assumed or ascended into heaven in some sort of a way. So what happened to their bodies? Well, the way that this is looked at generally by theologians is that their bodies and their soul, like their entire person, goes to the eschaton. Eschatology meaning the study of the end times and things, right? And the eschaton would be the new heavens and the new earth. So God, being outside of time, you know, can create realities outside of time. And so I think in a very real way, it is true that the bodies of Jesus and Mary, and possibly people like Enoch and Elijah, are in the new heavens and the new earth as we speak, in this time, right? And I think that idea, really, for me at least, makes a lot of sense with the idea of corruptionism, which I've talked about in the past. I have a number of episodes on, I think at least 3 episodes on this idea. But again, for those who haven't listened to it, corruptionism is the idea that after we die, our soul and our body are separate. And so from a certain view of human nature, that would mean that our human person no longer exists, because the human person is only the composite of our bodies and our souls. And so once our bodies and our souls are separate, the human person no longer exists, and, you know, a probable effect of that is that we can't really have experience because, you know, we can't really have experience without our bodies, basically, is how this goes. And so from a corruptionist point of view, what would happen is once I die, the first thing I'm going to experience is the resurrection of my soul and body composite at the end of time, within the new heavens and the new earth, right? The reason I find, and you can go back and listen to all those explanations on this issue, the reason I find this idea of Jesus and Mary's bodies and souls, their whole persons, basically being in the new heavens and the new earth right now, that's where they are, where their locality is, basically. The reason I find that salient is because, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense. I realized that wasn't really an explanation. Let me try to explain that better. I think that meshes a lot better with this idea that I take of corruptionism. Because if somehow, you know, Jesus, because some people will also say Jesus and Mary's assumed bodies are in that sort of interim state by some sort of miracle of God, which of course is possible, but doesn't make a lot of philosophical sense, because by definition that interim state is reserved for disembodied souls that are in the beatific vision, right? So I don't know. It's just it's interesting, this issue. And as I'm talking here, you know, I'm trying to flesh this out a little more, and I'm running out of time here. But I do think it's an interesting prospect that Jesus and Mary's body would be in the new heavens and the new earth because of that whole idea of there not being a gap of time, basically. You know, in a certain sense, in God's eternity, the new heavens and the new earth exist now. They exist now in God, right? And so there's nothing necessarily wrong with the idea that the bodies of Jesus and Mary would just, you know, automatically be in that place. Because the new heavens and new earth is an actual place. The interim state, you know, where the soul separated from the body is in the beatific vision, isn't really a state, or isn't a place, it's a state, right? It's a state of soul. It's not like a locality. Because a soul can't be in a locality in the same way that an angel can't be in a locality, because they have no physicality, right? And only physical things can be in locations. Like God is not in any sort of a location. That'd be a really problematic view. So, anyway, I hope this is insightful for you guys. I realize I'm not explaining this super great, but maybe that's something for next time we can talk about, is this idea of the eschaton, where our bodies go, where the bodies of Jesus and Mary go. I kind of want to flesh this out a little more just for myself to be able to get this together. I mean, like I've said, this podcast for me in a lot of ways is tracking, the development of my thought in many ways. So, you know, it's for you guys, definitely, but it's also for me a little selfishly. So, yeah. All right. We will talk next time. God bless y'all.
Real quick, please feel free to subscribe to any of my podcasts on any of the podcast players. Find me on YouTube. Please subscribe. Like me on Facebook, like the Catholicism Car channel on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We're all there, Catholicism Car. And then I also have a Patreon account if you wish to support what I do at this podcast and this YouTube channel. And you can also support us on anchor.fm. There's a support button there you click on. I also have links to all of this on my website's support page at www.catholicisminthecar.com.